Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So let's astro-mytho-cahoot for collective well-being. For those of you lucky enough to be in the Washington, D.C. area, on Saturday, December 22nd, I will be doing my astro-mytho-political celebration with fantastic musicians, Lilt, and that's at 5 p.m. Twilight, you know, in Washington, D.C. You can find out more at coyotenetworknews.com. Yesterday there was a portentous meteor over the Bay Area. Well, meteors often presage the downfall of tyrants. We're bound to hit an augury at one point. So here we are at the dark of the year, and more than perfectly, you know, we are gathering to consider with the stars to avert further disaster against the stars. So we welcome one of my favorite allies, the return of fellow astro-mytho-political guiding meta-narrative liberating cultural hijinks ally Daniel Gemario at this potent time when internal dedication magnetizes outward opportunity. Cooperators are standing by, and we are willing to meet them this hour and forever, that we humans may humbly cooperate with nature's guiding genius, also known as Trickster. So this is the time of the birth of the liberating trickster world redeemer in each of our hearts. Daniel Gemario's websites are the Gemario Approach, that's G-I-A-M-A-R-I-O, approach.com, and shamanicastrology.com. Welcome, Daniel.
Caroline, hey, here I am again. Can you hear me?
I could hear you very loudly and now a little faintly, so somewhere in the middle would be great. That's good. That's perfectly wonderful. We'll set forth. So, yeah.
I turned it up a little bit. Is this okay, Caroline?
Yeah, it sounds great. Yeah, that's right. Okay. We'll honor it. So the charts of today, the charts of the solstice, the charts of the unfolding year, all of that, you know, there's so many ways to dive in. But I just want to introduce, you know, that Uranus often stations around Christmas time, solstice time, but I really love this one. It's its last time at 28 plus Aries, the music of the spheres, and it's stationing retrograde inward, reminding us that this is a time of inward reflection as well as outward woofing. And then it goes forward direct on January 6th, Epiphany. It's also when Befana, the Christmas witch, distributes, you know, gifts. So are you heartened? Are you happy to align with this Uranus station?
I'm also tremendously looking forward to its final ingress into Taurus.
Yes.
March 6th.
Oh, really? May 7th, yeah. I have it, but okay, but March 6th.
Do I have that
okay.
wrong? I think March 6th, just a minute. Yikes. What could I have possibly...
You're right. No, you're right. Never mind me. March 6th, that's right. Okay, that's right. That's good. Yes, all right. Okay, even allies have their skirmishes backstage. Yeah, March 6th, that's right, 2019 through April 2026. So, yes. Feel free to unfurl your take on the guiding of Uranus, nature's evolutionary ingenious trickster, moving into Taurus. And
last time we talked, I started to presage a theme that has been very heavily on my consciousness since that time, is that I think it's a very helpful balancing energy to the fact that the current Mars cycle, it happens to be emphasizing the sign of Aquarius. And so we have that basic relationship between Uranus and which its resonance with Aquarius, and with the Mars journey that we're currently in, emphasizing Aquarius, the Uranus ingress into Taurus is helping balance that out. Otherwise, we get nothing but shadow of Aquarius, and that would be technocracy. You know, the putting in 5G everywhere, stuff like that. You know, way in which the technocrats have hijacked things. I'm watching that, of course, big time over here in the Philippines, being able to see what's happening in China. I don't know whether the U.S. gets all the news about what is happening in China, you know, with the social credit scores and, you know, people not being able to get on trains or buy food if they have the wrong social credit scores.
Right. There is that. So we honor the shadow of what happens when we don't follow the guiding. And I like to think of the Aquarius to Taurus. It says, well, you know, what does every society within each one of us and outwardly need? And you know, the Aquarius theme, and then Taurus says a continual touchback with nature's guiding genius and to re-wed human society to cooperating. Yeah, because we do have a winter solstice cauldron available to everybody to throw into the cauldron. There we go, hubris, corruption, so many things, complaining, you know, there we go, and, you know, arguing for our limitations, and ladle out, you know, the desirable dynamic. And so, you know, that's something for everybody to play with at home. Try this at home. So what do we want to release? There we go, human hubris. So, yeah, it's good to honor, to acknowledge the shadow.
There's a great deal of hubris that can be found in Aquarius. Actually, I've spent a large a bit of the last year researching actually documents from the late 60s and early 70s that were essentially foreshadowing and presaging exactly the situation that's taken place on the planet now. If a certain element of the, quote, Aquarian age was to run roughshod over nature, over shamanism, over involution, over our capacity to be fully human in the body and on the planet and in our connection with the earth and our organic reality.
And let's bring in our great ancestor anarchist, Sir Herbert Reed, who said, only those serving an apprenticeship to nature can be trusted with technology. We go, thank you. Thank you, Sir Herbert.
Well, that is so great because we actually... I was not aware of that quote. However, in our school, I generally teach our students that it's not that we are against technology, but rather that we must first have an apprenticeship with nature before we use it, and then it's a choice.
Right. And something dear to our hearts in our long conversing, I like saying that, you know, we'll bring in everybody, but Neptune, how a culture tells itself its own story through, you know, the myth, the dreams, the music that move through group mind, and that humans, you know, traditionally would symbolically stash their science in fairy tales and myths. As we know, you know, we often speak about the Inanna myth is the Venus astronomical cycle, and I'm very fond of the fairy tale Rapunzel, in which William Irwin Thompson derives the orbital cycle of the Moon, Mars, and Venus, the entire biological history on the planet Earth, and more, and plants. And so what happened, we're redressing a lot of curves in the human journey, our species, the unsupervised, you know, kind of, I don't know, science team, I guess, said we don't need these symbolic languages like astrology, or these myths and fairy tales, we want just knowledge, right? And so what it did was it stripped knowledge from its moral, mythological, guiding cocoon that all knowledge be used with a dedication to collective well-being. And now we come back to that, you know, and the renaissance of biomimicry and humbly cooperating. So it's neck and neck, right? I mean, destruction and beauty, but we're betting on beauty.
And speaking of, you know, still looking at the mythic stories that might sound Uranus, as I'm sure many astrologers know, and you know, that at one point it was going to be named Prometheus. And there's still a view of among some astrologers that it's more Promethean than a sky god. And we must remember Zeus's warning to Prometheus. Now that you've stolen the fire, remember two possible things that go wrong. Hubris, right? And the other is failing to remember about justice. Without justice and with hubris, then you have a nightmare there. And good on you for stealing the fire, but beware of those two things.
Right. So we might throw all together now. We're throwing human hubris, the hubris of humanism into the cauldron and ladling out the truth of animism and justice and all those good things. So into the cauldron and out of the cauldron, there we go. It's, you know, the symbols are eager to incarnate. Because I don't know if you noticed one of the beautiful patterns of our cahooting right now, but we have the moon at 4 Gemini, which is a radical magazine spreading liberating ideas. Yes, may it be in all of our hearts. Quintiles Mars in Pisces. What kind of Mars do we want to encourage? The reverent protector, you know, the kindness and protection. And then Mars in turn quintiles Saturn, and Saturn by quintiles back to the moon. So it's very beautiful. And I love a friend of mine, hi there, Sylvia in Vallejo, who said quintiles, they are irresistible eloquence, but they're also the capacity to open portals. And I go, excellent, I'll go for that. So we want to open portals for Mars positive yang to be described as the protector who is kind and maybe helped along with the help of the underworld psilocybe mushrooms that, you know, calm down the amygdala, as Paul Stamets reminds us, and so does Johns Hopkins studies, and increase confidence and kindness. And as Stamets says, those are leadership qualities, right? So so let's open the door for that, because we also have the winter solstice and full moon, right? And I love this full moon, the full moon in the moon in her own sign of Cancer, Big Mama's sign of fierce protection of life, opposite Sun in Capricorn, are structures of governance, right? So it's really a direct assignment to align with, you know, teasing the best of humans into our governance and the conversations that want to happen about what is the purpose of government and what is good leadership. But to toss back to you, you know, that model of it born in each heart. There was an article going around that's interesting enough on egalitarian foraging that reminds us in the Aquarius way that humans have organized themselves in many, many different ways, not just this current thing. And it speaks about the egalitarian foragers, where altruism and team play are high, you know, highly, you know, valued, and that, you know, it was, again, each person, the group itself, had the Saturn, had the authority, and there was a built-in mechanism to suck the chi out of tyranny when it arose, because everyone, the people, were like, no, bad manners, go sit in the corner. So we do want to bring alive all past as well as future good organizational.
That's a very good portion, Caroline, of the work I've been involved in the last 6 years is exactly on this theme. In that workshop I do called The Renaissance of the Sacred Feminine, the whole thing is in revealing the 200,000-year history, not just the what we've been led to believe is true about human beings over the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, a time of cooperative, egalitarian, peaceful human beings on this planet that I think has regressed. There's been no evolution from the time of what I like to refer to as the triple aberration. And I think we've discussed this before, monotheistic fundamentalism, hierarchical patriarchy, and patrilineal family descent. As I've done so much traveling in the last number of years, and I know you have too, and one thing I'm always trying to find, where are the people who had been previously matrilineal, and there are still some of them here on the planet, but those are the ones that have the most heart. I mean, I went to Egypt, and who are the people with heart there? It's the Nubians and the Berbers. You know, so each area has a reconnection point, or still has an alive connection point back to our egalitarian, cooperative, Gaelic roots that we've been led to believe did not exist, and that we've only always been warlike chimps, you know. The other factor, which it was reading the book called Earth Memory, a brilliant, brilliant book, Lynn Kelly's book about ancient sites, that she made it finally clear to me what's really taken place, because there have always been elites, but to be an elite originally meant wisdom and knowledge. And those that were rulers had to also be philosophers. And when that whole thing shifted around, so now that elites are based on money and how many guns you have, you really have an example of devolution.
Right. Well, the toxic mimic supplanting the authentic. So we're throwing the toxic mimic into the cauldron, ladling out the authentic. But say the name of Lynn Kelly's book again. What is that?
I might have said the name wrong. Lynn Kelly, she's from Australia, and she did the cross-cultural around the world, looking and seeing that stone circles and many ritual objects used by Aboriginal and Indigenous people are memory devices for oral history. That it's a way of connecting areas of the brain that have been left stagnant recently. And she has applied those techniques that she learned by going to places like Newgrange and the stone circles of Karnak. And being Australian, she's also very familiar with the Aboriginal songline knowledge. And she relearned these techniques. And she now, in her 70s, actually ended up winning this competition that they have now for memory. You know, like people who try to remember as much as possible, and they have competitions for it. And by using these ancient Neolithic techniques, she now is the champion memory of Australia.
That's great.
I'm trying to see where in my library.
Well, yeah, we'll say it's
Lynn
we'll
Kelly. Dr. Lynn Kelly. Sorry, yeah.
And it might be called Earth Memory or something, but we can find it with Lynn Kelly. But let's honor the resonance now that you can correct my dates. But we know for sure, maybe longer, that humans have gathered at the winter solstice for 20,000 years ish. And what's going on there at Newgrange and virtually all over the world? You know, it's the first form of magic, really. O literal and symbolic light of sun, illuminate this painting, this writing at the back of the cave. This is the story we want to animate, you know, our guiding story, right? So, and then we bring the kind of customized what's available now and how important
that is. It was the 2,000 years of peace, dream, realization in Ireland of how you can balance sun, moon, and earth. And by the first rays of the sun entering into a womb, which just happened to be the exact stars of Cygnus the Swan, so it was all connected to a swan cult that would come in, that actually was a way of demonstrating through ceremony how masculine, feminine, sun, and moon can be in balance.
Right.
It worked for 2,000 years. We're talking about the Tua Dedannan.
So the 2,000 years are when?
The 2,000 years of peace from approximately 4,000 BC until it started to go away about 2,000 BC, but it really fell apart around 1500 BC when the patriarchal warlike Celtic tribes overran the Tua Dedannan.
Right. And I like our colleague Rick Tarnas's micro diagram in which he says, all right, so we start off and humans are, you know, inextricably intertwined with the natural world, and so the sense of self is like a little dotted circle. And then we get pyramids, right? And which have their beauty and it's really great, but we get a priesthood, and then we get the church and the state, double priesthood, and humans is the best, humans, rah rah. No, speciesism. Yeah. And then we get, you know, and then he curves around and he goes, and then, you know, there was the psychological we don't need this superstition stuff, but the sense of the circle of self is now closed at tremendous cost, you know, to intimate participation. And then around we go again, back to the animistic realm, taking all the quirks and befoibelments and terriblenesses and wonderfulnesses of that journey, but to come back on a kind of spiraling loop to participatory animism, right?
Well, he took that theme and built upon what had been presented in the early 70s by Rajar.
Oh, yeah, good.
The idea that for a long period of time, even what could be called ancient astrology or pre-horoscopic astrology was for the clans, for the people. It was ceremony. It was the connection with the land and the sky. And then along comes the time period around 600 BC, 500 BC, the analogy to that being astrologically the Uranus-Neptune-Pluto conjunction happening then. And then you have individual human consciousness, and then individual personal horoscopes, and so a whole movement toward even in astrology for separation from the tribe, from the clan, from the earth, becomes highly abstracted. Robert Hand's pretty good at pointing all that stuff out also. And so Rajar's view was that we needed to have a planetarization of consciousness. You have like a thesis, antithesis, and a synthesis, where the antithesis was the development of individual horoscopes and me. It's about me, individualism, but it needs to be reintegrated into the earth, into the planet as a grand synthesis. Otherwise, there won't be continuance of the way the human race is unfolding
right.
At this point.
But of course, you know, how we practice and how what's intrinsic to the language is this exquisite language of the individual separated by a thin membrane from the pulsing vast collective. And you know, and I do find it heartening, you know, pretty much all the people I talk to and, well, you know, mm-hmm. in sessions, you know, everybody's ready. To step up, to give their gift, to participate. So the value of uniqueness, individual, always as dedicated to how do we contribute to the collective well-being,
yes.
Right?
Well, if I wasn't really clear about what I was sharing there, it was not a judgment against the antithesis that basically was necessary to actually step out of the just pure, you know, clan, tribal kind of thing, and to develop the awareness of individual consciousness, but then at a certain point to reintegrate that back into the collective.
Right. And what I've been ruminating on lately with self and working with others is when people go, what's going to happen? It's like, no, it's not what's going to happen. It's what are we going to make happen? And what's being proffered to us to collaborate with. And in my own journey, you know, I realize that sometimes I've overpitched the Jupiter transit, going, oh, it's fantastic, and so it's just an opportunity to dance with this quality. It's available, you know. It requires our willingness to participate. So we're kind of tossing fortune telling into the cauldron and ladling out, you know, responsibility and capacity to dance with the choreography of creation. There we go. So,
well, it's interesting you bring up the Jupiter factor, and yes, I think it has been the tendency of many astrologers to over glamorize the Jupiter transit. But this most recent a transit of Jupiter through Scorpio, I know in my own practice, as well as looking at world figures, that if there happens to be some specific challenge, you know, a complex, you know, something with Saturn, Pluto associated with that part of the chart, good grief, when Jupiter hits that point, it expands that person's their confrontation with the complex. The best example I know of is Mark Zuckerberg, that, you know, has all these planets in Scorpio, you know, I mean, the moon in Scorpio, Mars, Jupiter hit that right at the time period when essentially Facebook got called out.
It's an ongoing thing. Well, we are grateful to the external form of Jupiter in the form of the judiciary, right? So the Attorney General of Washington, D.C., one of the most enlightened in the country, is suing Facebook because, you know, the enticements when people go, oh, take this little personality quiz and give up all of your contacts, which is what happened to a company that sold it to Cambridge Analytica. So the Attorney General of Washington, D.C. is suing for that. And then we love, you know, Judge Emmett Sullivan in the district, appointed by Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Clinton, who said, No, wait a minute, Flynn. Wait, I'm appalled and disgusted at the scope of your, is it treason? And everybody had to go research, you know, treason, because nobody knew what the legality of treason was. But we go, yay, Ninth Circuit, yay, suing on behalf of asylum seekers, yay, you know, there's some qualities to the externalized Jupiter. And maybe we want to speak as you know, this potent time as destruction, the destruction of the Supreme Court and the thing and the whatever, as it goes down, you know, we want, you know, we work with everything to have the desirable structures in place to rise up out of, like the rebuilding of Puerto Rico as sustainable energy, not just the duplication of the thing. So we don't welcome destruction, but when it happens, as it is and will, you know, to have the structures that are really good for all beings, you know, in place, and many people are dedicated and working on that, right?
Well, you actually brought up something there that I feel compelled to share with you. You may know about this since you mentioned about Cambridge Analytics. When Duterte, the president of the Philippines, was elected in 2016, it was that's where they tested all of that out. They basically hired a team, because so many poor people here, and so they basically hired this vast army of trolls, and in combination with Facebook and Cambridge Analytics, and said, okay, let's see what we can do in the Philippines. And they tested it out, and then they were ready just to have the whole sort of army of trolls to turn the election in the United States. But they essentially tested that whole thing out on the Philippines first, as unfortunately it happens here for a lot of things. This is where GMOs get tested first, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
It's like a canary in the mine shaft here in some ways. There was a whole thing actually on Democracy Now! Regarding that, and the woman who exposed that has now been arrested and is in, I think she's out on bail, but they arrested her here when she got back to the Philippines after exposing the whole thing that happened in 2016 that got Duterte elected.
Right, and
I was going to say, the problem is that here in the Philippines and many parts of the Third World, Facebook is free, but in order to link to any new actual news items, you have to pay for that.
Ooh.
So 97% of Filipinos have Facebook, and it's free, and that's where they're getting all the information, and they're influenced by the vast army of trolls that are paid by whoever wants to influence opinion.
Yeah. Well, but also let's honor our creative suspiciousness, our autonomy, our savvy trickster, you know, against all odds wish, because the trolling and the increasing reporting of what's been done, the amazing amount of, you know, creating, you know, divisions and enmity and starting, you know, toxic mimics of Black Lives Matter things and encouraging blacks to not vote, don't vote for these, all that, you know, if we were not bamboozleable, you know, and it also goes like, and if the Democrats hadn't written those sketchy, horrible emails about Bernie, you know, I mean, there's a complicity in that thing too, going, if they hadn't done terrible things, then the exposure of them, you know, wouldn't have been possible. So, but if we are unsnookerable, unbamboozleable, so we want to encourage that, you know, autonomy that everyone can feel the resonance of what's true, you know, and not numb themselves to that, as opposed to being snookered into a false conflict, or any conflict even, right? Because we want to throw hot conflict into the cauldron and ladle out spiraling and liberating, that we be agents of liberating spirals and not snookered into polarity. But I just want to again pitch this oft-worked but important theme too, which is, you know, the dementors, the chaos magicians, the Bannons, who are quite savvy about kind of power of imagination and visualizing and all that stuff. you know, they thrive on heat and conflict and the opposite of truth. And so they do things that are appalling and that make us angry, of course, but the anger feeds them. So the evolutionary thing is to have the anger arise and then to Pluto, to alchemize it into desire and magnetizing the desirable story. Come on over here, right? So that we're not feeding, please don't feed the Dementors. Oh, there you go, because they love all that. They love the heat and the conflict and a complete contempt for truth and for that which they deem weak, which includes all of nature and women and children and well, almost everybody, really. So that's the challenge, right, is to not react, reaction into the cauldron, and pull out myriad forms of ingenious response. What is that, yeah.
Well, I love the fact that we're doing the show under a Gemini moon. The entire lineage of the trickster is contained within the Gemini moon lineage.
Right.
And so we would have the trickster being the one who can, with humor, but also with truth, to be able to be the only one who can call out the... the foibles of the rulers, to tell the king the truth and to move things forward, you know, not to have it be about fear, but have it to be about caricature and myth and create freedom through that.
Ah, goodness, I was magnetized, mesmerized by your speaking. We just flew past the half-hour mark. We're going to take a very short break here for our usual Taj Mahal. Our wonderful guest is Daniel Gemario. His website is gemarioapproach.com and shamanicastrology.com, and we will be right back after Taj.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them crossed his eye. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Allies to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our wondrous guest, co-dancer, astro-mytho guide is Daniel Gemario. His website is thegemarioapproach.com and also shamanicastrology.com. There we go. So, yes, we are magnetizing, liberating trickster redeemer to incarnate into each of our hearts, right? Not into a leader, into everybody. Everybody as leader. There we go. You know, and we are gathering to honor all that's been lost in 2018. There's so much. And I think, you know, grief metabolized into art becomes a sacrament of kinship. You know, there was somebody who did a beautiful song and video to honor the Paradise Fire. And it was so beautiful, this yearning. And again, the grief as art is our extending kinship to all, you know, to all beings, all the humans and the plants and the creatures and the everything who have lost so much. And then we're ladling out of the cauldron, defiant joy, liberating trickster luck. I'll be doing an event in Washington, D.C. on Saturday at 5 p.m. at twilight, neither night nor day. It's the time when magic happens, and you can find out more about that at coyotenetworknews.com. But back to us, Daniel, because we have so much sky and ground to cover. There's such a rich field hopping up and down before us. So one thing that astrologers have noted is that as 2019 unfurls before us, that Jupiter will be in its own sign of Sagittarius for the first time in 12 years. Neptune is in its own sign of Pisces every 165 years. Saturn will be in its own sign of Capricorn every, you know, 29-ish years. So we might say that these qualities of storytelling and dedication, you know, and imagination are strong, right? They're available.
Totally. And what an amazing presaging and precursor to then what happens in 2020.
Okay.
When we have Saturn and Jupiter and for a short period of time, Mars and Pluto all gathered in Capricorn. Which has not happened in 700 years to have that gathering in Capricorn. When people say, "Well, what do you think is going to happen?" You know, particularly with the and we don't in shamanic astrology we don't do prediction. What we do is we try to tune into the intent of a time frame and try to be in alignment with what the intent is. But the sense I have about it is, I think maybe 100 years from now, 200 years from now, when the future folks look back on 2020, when those planets were gathered in Capricorn at such an astounding time within the turning of the ages, that they'll look back on that time and say, yeah, that was the tipping point. That was the tipping point. That's when the mass mind, the collective, became aware that things could not just continue the way they are. I mean, many of us that are looking at this in a different way for a long time now might think the tipping point has already happened. But I think that's when the collective becomes entirely aware that the system that has been in place depending on what part of the world we're in, starting 6,000 years ago in the Americas, it didn't shift until about 1,000 A.D. But the big change that shifted into what I referred to before as the triple aberration, that's the tipping point. So future culture will look back on 2020 as when it reached a boiling temperature, I guess you could say.
Well, and there's many ways this story could go, which is why we're gathered here, you know. And you know, just to tease us back into immediacy as well as extending there, 200 years forward is a good idea. And how do we tell the story backwards about how it turned out, you know, as good as possible? I love even today, just for the fun of it, Venus is at 13 Scorpio, coming up on both of our Venuses, and right next to Ceres, Demeter, dwarf planet.
Not my Venus, my Mars.
Your Mars, sorry about that. That's right, exactly. woof, yes, exactly. Very, very good. And but I love Venus at 13 plus Scorpio. That's Edward Snowden's moon. And the image, the Sabian symbol for it, think Edward Snowden, is telephone linemen at work installing links to other realities, the cosmic switchboard. It's very witty in regard to Edward Snowden. And so Venus at 13 Scorpio is exactly trining 120 degree angle Neptune at 13 Pisces, which is Stormy Daniels Mars. So I like putting the quirky cultural team together, going, right, Edward Snowden, Stormy Daniels, the Parkland Youth, you know, because in many ways that they're very different, right? But they're really good at spiraling out of polarity, all of them, you know, and metabolizing poison. All of them. And so we kind of want to put our quirky, mythological, incarnate, ancestral team together, you know, and each one of us also kind of customize our own, by affinity, you know, guiding trickster from all that we love that's ingenious and successful, as, you know, coyote and raven and resilient seeds that sprout after cataclysm and other things that we all gather and go, yeah, we want to be like that. Because it is this powerful time of dedication, and this invisible visible reminds us that we can't even be who we want to be by ourselves, which is why we dedicate and supplicate in a sense, going, hold me to this. This is the art form quality of being I want to be. This is the effect or the influence I want to contribute to in the world. You know, hold me to this thing. And it's such a powerful time to do that.
Yeah.
And as you were saying about Jupiter, the way I like to play with it, because we have Jupiter in Sagittarius, right next to Mercury, Hermes, mind, opposite the moon in Gemini, you know, that everyone in every conversation and every media outlet, it is an opportunity, you know, to smuggle wisdom into mainstream, sometimes disguised as entertainment. But a lot of people are really kind of working on this. But the way I currently pitch Jupiter is, you know, Jupiter goes, I will make you, you know, everybody wealthy by their own definition of wealth. We hand it to Saturn to define that. What do we want to feel like? What do we want to feel like to others? They go together. But then Jupiter says, and what you were referencing, I'm going to make everything bigger. So whatever you don't want bigger, throw it into the end of the year cauldron, going, let's say we've gotten all the good out of petty intrigue. Oh, come on. Throw it into the cauldron. Like, we can't afford that team. And ladle out, you know, the grand intrigue of the transformation of culture, which is why I'm also very in favor of just everybody priming the pump. But let's throw complaining into the cauldron, right? Because it's just such a waste. And there are whole relationships based on reciprocal complaining. And we go, no, that is a relationship of reciprocal infantilization. So I want to throw complaining in there, you know, and label out, you know, whatever, dedication, praising. Or as, you know, Robert Bly's Kabir would say, your depression is caused by your inability to praise. And we go, okay, it's a little finger waggy, but it's kind of a good Saturn thing going, right. So, you know, the praising is also to be, but I also want to bring in the spicy Scorpio qualities that are all available to us now, as Wendell Berry says, be jaunty, even though fully informed. I mean, this is about compassion with sizzle, meaning it's not like, la, 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 everything's great. It's like, no, it's really dark, and we're going to love it, and we're going to love the good part of the dark as well.
It's the joy that anyone has who's working with plants. There is a joy when the composting time comes.
Yes, yes.
And I'm looking at the planetary configuration in Capricorn as it approaches the Pluto return of the United States as a time of joyful composting. I mean, to me, I'm using the word compost a great deal for Pluto.
All the time.
So out of compost comes new life. You know, so there's a celebration around the composting. In our school, from the very beginning, even when we put in our stone circle in New Mexico about 20 years ago. Everything was oriented toward the December solstice. I mean, the final stone went in at the point of the December solstice, right as the solstice sun was setting over the source of the hot springs. I mean, it was one of those magical things that really made us clear that the December solstice is really the prime point in global calendrics right now, not the equinoxes, but the December solstice. And I'm saying December solstice because then that brings in the very same mysteries happening in the Southern Hemisphere also, because it's that exact point in the sky which is associated with the galactic center, which mythically, here now we're going to get into the mythic stories here, seven different cultures around the planet perceived that point in the sky is basically where we could say souls leave, or where the composting happens, where the Golden Gate, the place where creation goes to be reborn. And depending on how you look at it, it's all people that are that love and light perspective. It's like we're going to ascend there. But actually, it's also the die-off point, you know, the point of composting. That which needs to be composted goes out that gateway. And since 1962 to 2034 is the time period that we've ascertained as being the turning of the ages, ground zero, not 2012, not 1999, not any one specific date in there, but it's a zone of 1962 to 2034 when this massive composting of the particular age that we're reaching the crescendo of shifts into something else.
We might want a different metaphor than ground zero, but we get the gist of it. There we go.
Well, okay, let's say reset. How about reset?
Reset is good. Renewal. Many things. Yeah, no, it's good. It's good to play because part of the expansion for all of us, it says, you know, it's all about participatory intimacy. So the more, I mean, Uranus part of all of us chimes in and says, we are big parts of the divine dancing with everything. We don't care what you humans do. We care the manner in which you do it, that it come from freedom and choice and discerning. So, you know, the more language we have, the more metaphor, the more eloquence extends our range of intimate participation. And one of the beautiful themes, you know, some things are always true, but times when they're truer, is that Venus in Scorpio, the art form of dancing with the invisible, trine Neptune, says, you know, metaphors are the incarnational garb whereby power enters the world. Neptune sextile Saturn. So we say, you know, the protoplasm of reality is especially receptive to imaginative imprint right now. I mean, it's always a good idea, but, you know, really backstage is trying to help out the humans. So, you know, what we dedicate to now, the metaphors we use, the language, the words we use, and it's not about being tiptoey, like, oh, I said a bad thing. It's the predominant habitual default setting that's really important.
I'm in entire agreement with you. In fact, a rather major contribution that I believe that our school is making is changing the language around words that we assume we know what they mean, but they actually cause a different reaction than what we would want. We don't even use the word opposition. We use the word resonant polarity as opposed to opposition. You know, like when you have two planets that are opposite each other, we don't emphasize opposition. We call it resonant polarity because I think they have more in common than not. We've abandoned rulership, actually.
Yeah, because, me too. Right.
Because it has a certain hierarchical connotation to it. Many of the words in the traditional astrological language are an artifact of a certain time in history, which is primarily male-dominated and hierarchically based.
Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, we've been in DNA spiraling accord for a long part of our journey, which is great. Yeah, to throw, you know. Because I often, you know, for self and others, I go, well, to be a Sagittarius, the old language says ruled by Jupiter, but really what it means is incarnation of Jupiter. There you go. And then we fall back to it because the antique, you know, has some value because we then go, you know, the ruler of the rising sign, just for efficiency. But absolutely. And we certainly are eager to throw all priesthoods, all obfuscating, mediating, tyrannical priesthoods into the cauldron and ladle out, you know, direct autonomous guidance to, you know, to mystery. So, right. And we do honor that, you know, astrology, as Tarna says, it became the gold standard of contempt, this exquisite, beautiful language of interrelatedness. But there is some, you know, I love Marsilio Ficino in Florence, you know, berating the Florentine astrologers for encouraging superstition and being a priesthood, right? And he's like, no, that's not what this is for, you guys, you know. So, any outsourcing of Saturn, like, oh, the psychic or the astrologer told me that this would happen. Now, we're in a complex realm here because there is such a thing as predictive, and that is one true story sometimes, but for all of us to not outsource our autonomy to politicians or priests or astrologers or psychics or anybody, but as long as it has a resonant and liberating guiding about what to do, that's, I think, part of the criterion we're putting in place. Is that
well? It's Jeffrey Cornelius.
I love him.
I mean, you can't, prediction isn't really possible because objective time doesn't exist. And that so that the magic that happens when you do astrology is the soul-to-soul encounter that's happening in that moment.
That's cool.
And which is why it is that a beginner astrologer who knows very little about astrology, if they sit with a client at the right moment, with the right openness of that a client, can come up with the exact same magical information in that moment as somebody who's been a 40-year astrologer who has had 50,000 readings behind them. There's something magic happens in the moment. It's a divination because you can't step outside the system. We're in a in that one reality, you know, as it is in the Emerald Tablet,
right.
In the unfoldment, right. The one thing is the pattern, and you can sit with someone with a magical language and magical metaphors, and in that moment, out of that can come guidance, can come insight, can come a connection to our soul, a connection to our purpose, and I think that's the what's really happening when astrology is making a contribution.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up Geoffrey Cornelius. He is one of our great, great astrological scholars, as his doctorate from Cambridge University in the history of divination. And when I hosted him a million years ago, and it's good just to bring this up, you know, he said, you know, we do have most of the questions that were asked at the Delphic Oracle, and they're not really fortune-telling, although the Delphic Oracle was, you know, a smartass at one point saying, you know, what will happen if I invade Persia? An empire will fall. It'll be yours, ha ha ha. But what Geoffrey says is mostly people ask, you know, are our plans in accord with the gods or the larger pulse of the design of nature? And if not, yes. What should we do to come into accord? Very sensible, yeah. But, well, that, and that's where we started off, you know, to consider as opposed to disaster, right? To pit our small wills against that, going, no, tantrum yoga. And so partly also, right now, just for the fun of it, it's a highly fluctuating field. Rather than be wired and tired, let's dedicate to settling everything down, you know. And the U.S. government staying open would, without one penny to the dastardly, horrific cartoon of the wall, would be good, would be kind to people who are depending on those checks and myriad other things. And we're just putting that out there into the memosphere because, you know, Trumpelstiltskin, tantrum yoga guy, is like, and we go, yeah, well, people are often, do people ask you, like, when will he go? You know, when, how long will this last? And if so, what do you respond?
Well, when I'm traveling around and people see that I'm an American, they don't always assume that. Sometimes I'm thought of as a Canadian or an Australian. I do have to handle the Trump questions, and you know, but I have an advantage. I say, well, I'm an American expat, and I have no idea how it is that 40% of the American population will just accept. No matter what he does, then he's their champion and their hero. I'm amazed that actually I have a few friends, friends from years back that are. True believers in the QAnon phenomena, you know, that still are
right.
Believing that
yes.
That Trump is our wonderful redeemer that is going to expose, you know, the deep state. I'm just amazed by that because I have to go by my heart, which is that people are being hurt by this man's behavior, and the ends do not justify the means.
Right. No, and what it says to all of us listening, and we do want to be effective change artists and to magnetize everybody, talk across borders, not down. Condescension means we all go down together. But so what it represents, of course, is people are hungry for a mission. They're hungry for a story. They're hungry for, you know, to be in the know, you know, and it's like, okay, so compost the toxic thing and magnetize the invitation over here. Here we go. There we go. Which is why biomimicry and the Biomimicry Institute and Janine Benyus is so wonderful because it's so elegant when you see the solutions of, you know, how, you know, it's, you know, that all the issues we're facing are kind of, you know, design issues. Who is it? Oh, important contributor. His name will come back to me. But he always says, you know, in his lectures, you know, the ship crossing the ocean, who's in charge? And people go, the captain. And he goes, nope, the designer. And all of the issues we're facing are design issues. And so that's, you know, both on stage and backstage, you know, to compost our own condescension and harumphitude and disrespect and to speak to, you know, that in, this is where astrology is really great, to speak to that in others we want to quicken, that, you know, whatever we speak to in another is the part of them we're inviting to dance with the corresponding part of ourselves. So yeah. I do find the astrological language so heartening, going, everybody's got a Neptune somewhere. Everybody's got a dedication to collective well-being somewhere. It might have gone to sleep. It might have been hoodwinked, but it's in there. You know,
Caroline, and the one thing the one thing we didn't get to discuss was the Venus and Mars cycle. And
let's do it.
Well, because it relates totally to what you're just bringing up right now.
We have time.
Is that just very, very briefly, I'll just get into the Venus part of it. On November 1st, Venus rose as a morning star to begin a new 584-day synodic cycle. And I get a lot of my insights about what's happening on the planet, what's happening with men, what's happening with women by looking at the Venus and Mars synodic cycles. That's not the sign they're in at any any day, but rather it's the primary archetypal energy for the entire cycle itself. And actually something happened November 1st, which is for the first time in 150 years, Venus rose as a morning star in the sign of Libra. Now, what a fascinating, we say, antidote in a sense, a complementary antidote to the one it was in before. It was in Aries before. For 584 days, the Venus energies, that means the feminine energy in both men and women, was rightly in Aries, you know, like warrior Amazon. Let's take action. Very much polarity based in a lot of ways. Aries requires like a mission and purpose that generally has to do with something that you're trying to overcome. And a lot needed to be overcome. I'm thinking of, the power of the feminine that was coming in there. But now, for the next 584 days, and we're in that time period now, it's in the sign of Libra. And that's the sign of guileline. That's the sign of collaboration. That's the sign of communication, of taking into account another person's perspective, to be able to connect with others as they are without judgment. And I understand that there can be a lot of, quote, weakness to Libra. I mean, actually, it's not the glamour sign of the zodiac anymore. Poor Libra. But actually, the strength of Libra is in collaboration, cooperation, and guileline. And I'm using the word guileline from, you know, from the great work of Rian Eisler.
Now we have 30 seconds for anything you want to say about Venus and Mars.
Saying that the Venus in Libra is basically giving us the clue for collaboration and cooperation and guileline.
And
as far as the Mars Aquarius thing, Mars and Aquarius is, I spoke about that at the beginning, you know,
right.
So that's the shadow of that, which is technocracy. So that we need to be concerned about what the shadow of Aquarius is and to connect it in with our earth being, our body, the land.
No geoengineering, no shooting dust so that the sunlight doesn't reach. No, stop that, guys. Right. So, and then very, very briefly, because we're almost there. But Mars and Aquarius, we're timing that from what?
Oh, that started on July 26, 2018. And it goes on for 26 months from that time period. So not until that great, amazing time in 2020 will the next Mars cycle be, and that'll be in Aries.
And what happened on... what happened on July 26, 2018? Mars did what?
That's when it was when it began its new cycle. That was the point of opposition. That was the point when Mars rose in the east at its very brightest as the sun was setting.
Thank you.
Beginning the journey that we now can see happening in the evening skies.
We're on our way out, but this is going to be obviously continued, our conversing in perpetuity. Thank you so much, Daniel Jamario, thejamarioapproach.com, shamanicastrology.com. I'm Caroline Casey. Thank you so much, Michael Cohn, K-O-H-N. He's our hero, Cohn. That's wonderful, and see many of you on Saturday, perhaps, and we are in perpetual cahoots. May it be so. Thank you again, Daniel. Woof.
My great pleasure. Talk to you again soon, Caroline. All right.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, yeah,